opulent major and Sunny circling around me as I lay on my mattress. "How did you end up here, with your best friend and blood brother overseeing your demise?" said the crapulent major. "Don't you think your life would have taken a different course if you hadn't killed me, not to mention mine?" said Sunny. "Do you know Sophia still weeps for me? I tried to visit her and put her at peace, but she can't see me, whereas you, who I would rather not see at all, can see me all the time. But I have to say that seeing you like this does give me some pleasure. Justice exists after all." I wanted to reply to these accusations and tell them to wait for my friend the Commissar to explain everything. But even in my head I was mute. All I could do was moan and protest, which only made them laugh. The crapulent major nudged my thigh with his foot and said, "See where your plotting has led you now?" He nudged me even harder, and I shuddered in protest. He kept nudging me with that foot, and I kept shuddering, until I realized it was not the crapulent major, but someone I could not see, pushing his heel against my leg. I felt the door clang shut again. Someone had entered without me knowing, or someone had been here the entire time and just left. How much time had passed, I couldn't be certain. Had I fallen asleep? If I had, then several hours must have gone by, perhaps an entire day. That must be why I was hungry. Finally, a part of me, my stomach, could be heard, groaning. The loudest voice in the world is the voice of one's own tortured stomach. Even so, this voice was still a quiet one compared to the angry beast it could be. I was not starving, not yet. I was just famished, my body having completely digested the wood pigeon that was actually a rat. Were they not going to feed me? Why was this being done to me? What had I ever done to him? I remembered this kind of hunger. I had experienced it so often in my youth, even when my mother served me 3/4 of a meal and saved only 1/4 for herself. "I'm not hungry," she said. When I was old enough to see that she was denying herself, I said, "I'm not hungry either, Mama." Our staring contest over the meager helping led us to push them back and forth, until her love for me overpowered mine for her, as always. Eating her portion, I swallowed not just the food but the salt and pepper of love and anger, spices stronger and harsher than the sugar of sympathy. "Why were we hungry?" my stomach cried. Even then I understood that if the rich could only spare all the hungry a bowl of rice, they would be less rich, but they would not starve. If the solution was so simple, why was anyone hungry? Was it only a lack of sympathy? "No," Nan said, as he taught me in our study group. Both the Bible and Das Kapital provided answers. Sympathy alone would never persuade the rich to share willingly and the powerful to give up power voluntarily. Revolution made those impossible things happen. Revolution would free us all, rich and poor. But by that, man meant freedom for classes and collectives. He did not necessarily mean that individuals would be freed. No, many revolutionaries had died in prison, and that seemed more and more as if it would be my fate. But despite my sense of doom, as well as my sweat, my hunger, my love, my rage, sleep almost overcame me. I was fading when that foot nudged me again, this time in the ribs. I shook my head and tried to turn onto my side, but my restraints would not let me. The foot nudged me once more. That foot! The demon would not let me rest. How I came to hate its horned toes scraping against my bare skin and pushing against my thigh, my hip, my shoulder, my forehead. The foot knew whenever I was on the verge of sleep, returning at exactly that moment to deny me even the slightest taste of what I needed so much. The monotony of darkness was challenging, and hunger was painful, but this constant wakefulness was even worse. How long had I been awake? How long had I been in what must be the examination room? When was he coming to explain everything to me? I could not tell. The only interruptions to mark the passage of time were that foot and the occasional touch of hands lifting my hood, loosening my gag, squirting water down my throat. I never got more than a word or two out before the gag was tightened again and the hood pulled down to my neck. Oh, let me sleep. I could touch its dark waters, and then that damn foot would nudge at me again. The foot would keep me awake until I died. The foot was slowly, ever so slowly, killing me. The foot was judge, guard, and executioner. Oh, foot, have sympathy for me. foot whose life is one of being stood upon, of being made to walk the dirty earth, neglected by all above. You, of all living things, should understand how I feel. Foot, where would we, humanity, be without you? You delivered us from Africa to the rest of the world, and yet so little is said about you. Clearly, you got a raw deal as compared with, say, the hand. If you let me live, I will dedicate words to you and make my readers realize your importance. Oh, Foot, I beg of you, nudge me no more. Stop rubbing your calluses on my skin. Don't scratch me with your sharp, uncut nails. Not that your calluses and nails are your fault. They are your negligent master's fault. I confess that I am just as heedless in the care of my feet, your kin. But I promise, if you just let me go to sleep, I will be a new man in regards to my own feet, to all feet. I will worship you, Foot, as Jesus Christ did when he washed the feet of sinners and kissed them. Foot, you are the revolution symbol, not the hand holding hammer and sickle. Yet we keep you hidden under the table or shod in a shoe. We abuse you, as the Chinese do, by binding you. Would we ever inflict such an injury on the hand? Stop prodding me, please, I beg of you. I recognize that humanity poorly represents you, except for when we spend copious amounts of money in dressing you, because you, of course, cannot represent yourself. Foot, I wonder why I never thought about you before, or hardly ever. The hand is free to do whatever it pleases. It even writes. No wonder more words have been written about the hand and the foot. We share something in common, Foot. We are the downtrodden of the world. If you would only stop keeping me awake, if only... This time the hand nudged me. Someone tugged at my hood, loosened it, and raised it above my ears, but kept it on my head. Then the hand pulled the muffs away and yanked the plugs out, and I heard the shuffling of sandals, the scraping of a chair or a stool on cement. "You idiot," the voice said. I was still in darkness, hands and feet still bound and encased, body naked and damp. Water was poured down my parched throat until I gagged. "Didn't I tell you not to come?" It came from far above me, somewhere in the ceiling. His voice. I was sure of it, even in my agonized state. "But how can I not come back?" I blubbered. "Mama told me the bird always returns to its nest. Am I not that bird? Is this not my nest, my origin, my place of birth, my country, my home? Are these not my people? Are you not my friend, my sworn brother, my true comrade? Tell me why you're doing this to me. I wouldn't do it to my worst enemy." The voice sighed. "Never underestimate what you can do to your worst enemy. But so far as this goes, what was it that priests like your father always said? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That sounds good, but things are never that simple. The problem, you see, is how to know what we want to have done to us." "I have no idea what you're talking about," I said. "Why are you torturing me? Do you think I want to do this to you? I am doing my best to make sure worse things don't happen to you. The Commandant already believes that I am being too gentle with my pedagogical methods, with my desire to hear your confession. He is the kind of dentist who believes toothaches can be treated by removing all of one's teeth with pliers. This is the situation you have gotten yourself into by doing exactly what I told you not to do. Now, if you have any wish of leaving this camp with your teeth intact, we must play out our roles until the Commandant is satisfied." "Please, don't be angry with me," I sobbed. I couldn't take it if you were angry at me, too." He sighed once more. "Do you remember writing that you forgot something, but that you couldn't remember what it was?" I told him I didn't remember. "Of course," he said. "Human memory is short and time is long. The reason you are here in this examination room is for you to remember what you forgot, or at least forgotten to write. My friend, I am here to help you see what it is you cannot see on your own." His foot nudged the base of my skull. "Here, at the back of your head." "What does that have to do with not letting me sleep?" I said. He laughed, not the laugh of the schoolboy who had enjoyed Tintin comics, but the laugh of someone perhaps just a bit mad. "You know as well as I why I cannot let you sleep," he said. "We must access that safe, hiding the last of your secrets. The longer we keep you awake, the better chance we have of cracking that safe. But I've confessed to everything. No, you haven't, the voice said. I am not accusing you of deliberately withholding, though I gave you many opportunities to write your confession in such a way as to satisfy the commandant. It is you who bring this on yourself, no one else. What am I supposed to confess to? If I told you what to confess to, then it would not be much of a confession, the voice said. But take comfort in knowing that your situation is not as impossible as you think. Do you remember our exams, when you would always score perfectly and I would miss a few points? Even though I read and memorized as feverishly as you, you always outdid me. I just couldn't get the answers to come out of my head. But they were there. The mind never forgets. When I looked at our textbooks again, I thought, of course, I knew them all the time. In fact, I know you know the answer to the question you must pass in order to finish your re-education. I will even ask you that question now. Answer it successfully, and I will free you from your bonds. Are you ready? Go ahead, I said, swelling with confidence. All I ever needed was a test to prove myself. I heard the rustle of paper, as if he was thumbing through a book, or perhaps my confession. What is more precious than independence and freedom? A trick question? The answer was obvious. What was he looking for? My mind was swaddled in something soft and clammy. Through it I could feel the hard, solid answer, but what it was I could not tell. Perhaps the obvious was indeed the answer. At last I told him what I thought he wanted to hear. Nothing, I said, is more precious than independence and freedom. The voice sighed. Almost, but not quite. Almost, but not right. Isn't it frustrating when the answer is right there, but one doesn't know what it is? Why, I cried, are you doing this to me? You are my friend, my brother, my comrade. A long silence ensued. I heard only the shuffling of paper and the rasp of his tortured breathing. He was sucking hard to ensure the passage of even a small amount of air. Then he said, "Yes, I am your friend, brother, comrade, all these things until I die. As your friend, brother, comrade, I warned you, didn't I? I could not have been any clearer. I was not the only one reading your messages, nor could I send you a message without someone looking over my shoulder. Everyone has someone looking over his shoulder here. And yet you insisted on returning, you fool." Bond was going to get himself killed. I had to come back to protect him. "And you were going to get yourself killed, too?" the voice said. "What kind of plan is that? Where would you two be if I was not here? We are the Three Musketeers, aren't we? Or perhaps now we are the Three Stooges. No one volunteers for this camp, but when I realized you would be returning, I demanded to be the commissar and to have the two of you sent here. Do you know who they put in this camp? The ones who chose to make a last stand, who continue to fight a guerrilla war, who will not recant or confess with proper contrition. Bond has already demanded twice to be shot by firing squad. The commandant would gladly have done it if not for me. As for you, your chances of survival would be doubtful without my protection. You call this protection? If it weren't for me, you would likely be dead already. I am a commissar, but above me are more commissars, reading your messages, following your progress. They dictate your re-education. All I can do is take charge of it and persuade the commandant that my method will work. The commandant would have put you on a demining squad, and that would be the end of you. But I have gotten you the luxury of a year riding in an isolation cell. The other prisoners would kill for your privilege. I don't mean that metaphorically. I've done you a big favor, getting the commandant to keep you locked up. In his eyes, you are the most dangerous of all subversives, but I've convinced him that the revolution is better off curing you than killing you. Me? Haven't I proven myself a true revolutionary? Haven't I sacrificed decades of my life in the cause of liberating our country? You, of all people, should know that. It is not me who needs convincing. It is the commandant. You do not write in any way a man like him can understand. You claim to be a revolutionary, but your story betrays you, or rather, you betray yourself. Why, you stubborn ass, do you insist on writing this way, when you must know that the likes of you threaten the commandants of the world? The foot nudged me awake. I had fallen asleep for one delicious instant, as if I had been crawling through a desert and tasted a tear. Stay awake, the voice said. Your life depends on it. You're going to kill me if you won't let me sleep, I said. I am going to keep you awake until you understand, the voice said. I understand nothing. Then you have understood almost everything, the voice said. He chuckled, and it sounded almost like my old schoolmate. Isn't it funny how we find ourselves here, my friend? You came to save Vaughn's life, and I came to save both your lives. Let us hope my plot works out better than yours. Truth be told, it wasn't purely out of friendship that I petitioned to be the commissar here. You have seen my face, or rather, my lack of one. Can you imagine my wife and children seeing this? The voice cracked. Can you imagine their horror? Can you imagine mine every time I look in the mirror? Although, to be honest, I have not looked at a mirror for years now. I wept, thinking of him exiled from them. His wife was a revolutionary, too, a girl from our sister school, of such integrity and simple beauty that I would have fallen in love with her if he hadn't first. His boy and girl must now be at least 7 and 8, little angels whose only fault was that they sometimes fought with each other. They would never look with fear on your condition, I said. You only imagine what they see through how you see yourself. You know nothing, he shouted. Silence ensued again, interrupted only by the rasp of his breathing. I could imagine the scars of his lips, the scars in his throat, but all I wanted was to sleep. His foot nudged me. I apologize for losing my temper, the voice said softly. My friend, you cannot know what I feel. You only think you can. But can you know what it is like to be so horrible that your own children cry when they see you? When your wife flinches at your touch? When your own friend does not recognize you? Bon has seen me this last year and not known who I am. True, he sits at the back of the meeting hall and only sees me from afar. I have not called him in to let him know who I am, because such knowledge would certainly do him no good and probably do him great harm. Nevertheless, I dreamed that he would recognize me despite myself, even if, in recognizing me, he would only want to kill me. Can you imagine the pain of losing my friendship with him? Perhaps you can. But can you actually know the pain of napalm burning the skin off your face and your body? How can you? Then tell me, I cried. I want to know what happened to you. Silence ensued. For how long, I do not know, until the foot nudged me again, and I realized I had missed the first part of his story. I was still wearing my uniform, the voice said. The sense of doom was thick among my unit, panic in the eyes of the officers and the men. With deliberation only hours away, I hid my joy and excitement, but not my worry for my family, even though they would be safe. My wife was at home with the children, one of our couriers close by to ensure their safety. When the tanks of the Liberation Army approached our bridge, and my commanding officer ordered us to stand firm, I worried for myself as well. I didn't want our liberators to shoot me on the last day of the war, and my mind was calculating how to avoid such a fate when someone said, "Here's the Air Force at last." One of our planes was overhead, flying high to avoid anti-aircraft fire, but also flying far too high for a bombing run. "Get closer," someone shouted. "How's he going to hit anything flying that high?" the voice chuckled. "How indeed." When the pilot dropped his bombs, the sense of dread possessing my fellow officers touched me, for I could see that the bombs, instead of falling toward the tanks, were falling toward us in slow motion. The bombs fell faster than our eyesight told us, and though we ran, we did not get far. A cloud of napalm engulfed us, and I suppose I was lucky. I ran faster than the others, and the napalm only licked me. It hurt, oh, how much it hurt. But what can I tell you besides the fact that being on fire feels like being on fire? What can I tell you about the pain except that it was the most horrendous pain I have ever felt? The only way for me to show you how much it hurt, my friend, is for me to burn you myself, and that I will never do. I, too, had come close to death on the tarmac of the Saigon airport, and again on the set of the movie, but neither experience was the same as being burned. At worst, I had been lightly scorched. I tried to imagine that, multiplied by 10,000, by a napalm that was the very light of Western civilization, having been invented at Harvard, or so I had learned in Claude's class. But I could not. All I could feel was my desire for sleep, as myself dissolved, leaving only my melting mind. But even in this buttery condition, my mind understood that this was not the time to talk about me. "I can't imagine," I said. "Not at all." It was a miracle that I lived. I am a living miracle, a human being turned inside out. I should be dead before my dear wife, who searched for me when I did not come home. She found me dying in an army hospital, a low-priority case. When she notified the powers that be, they ordered the best surgeons remaining in Saigon to operate on me. I was saved. But for what? The pain of being burned was hardly less than the pain of having no skin and no face. I was on fire every day for months. When my medication wears off, I still burn. Excruciating is the right word, but it cannot convey the feeling it describes. I think I know what excruciation feels like. You are only beginning to know. You don't have to do this. Then you do not understand. Certain things can be learned only through the feeling of excruciation. I want you to know what it is I knew, and still know. I would have spared you that knowledge if you had not come back. But you have come back, and the Commandant is watching. Left by yourself, you would not survive under his care. You frighten him. You are nothing but a shadow standing at the mouth of his cave, some strange creature that sees things from two sides. People like you must be purged because you bear the contamination that can destroy the revolution's purity. My task is to prove that you do not need to be purged, that you can be released. I have constructed this examination room exactly for this purpose. You don't have to do this, I muttered. But I do. What's being done to you is for your own good. The Commandant would break you the only way he knows how, through your body. The only way to save you was to promise the Commandant that I would test new methods of examination that would not leave a mark. That is why we have not beaten you even once. I should be thankful. Yes, you should. But now it is time for the final revision. The Commandant will accept no less. You must give him more than what you have. I have nothing left to confess. There is always something. That is confession's nature. We can never stop confessing because we are imperfect. Even the Commandant and I must criticize ourselves to each other, as the party has intended. The military Commandant and the political Commissar are the living embodiment of dialectical materialism. We are the thesis and the antithesis from which comes the more powerful synthesis, the truly revolutionary consciousness. If you already know what I forgot to confess, then tell me. The voice chuckled again. I heard the shuffling of papers. Let me quote from your manuscript, the voice said. The communist agent, with the papier-mâché evidence of her espionage crammed into her mouth, our sour names literally on the tip of her tongue. You mention her four more times in your confession. We learn that you pulled this list from her mouth and that she looked at you with mortal hatred. But we don't learn her fate. You must tell us what you did to her. We demand to know. I saw her face again, her dark peasant skin and broad flat nose, so similar to those broad flat noses of the doctor surrounding her in the movie theater. But, I said, I did nothing to her. Nothing? Do you think her fate is the thing you have forgotten, that you have forgotten? But how is her tragedy possible to forget? Her fate is so clear. Was there ever any fate for her that could be different from what a reader might imagine, seeing her in your confession? But I did nothing to her. Exactly. Don't you see how everything in need of confession is already known? You indeed did nothing. That is the crime that you must acknowledge and to which you must confess. Do you agree? Perhaps. My voice was faint. His foot nudged me again. Would he let me sleep if I said yes? It is time for me to rest, my friend. I can feel the pain again. The pain never goes away. Do you know how I tolerate it? Morphine, a voice chuckled. But that wonder drug only numbs the body and the brain. What about my mind? I have discovered that the only way to manage pain is to imagine someone else's greater pain, a suffering that diminishes your own. So remember what we learned in the Lycée, the words of Fan Boy Chow. For a human being, The greatest suffering comes from losing his country. When this human being lost his face, his skin, and his family, this human being imagined you, my friend. You had lost your country, and I was the one who exiled you. I felt deeply for you. The terrible loss only hinted at in your cryptic messages. But now you have returned, and I can no longer imagine your suffering to be greater than mine. I am suffering now, I said. Please, just let me go to sleep. We're revolutionaries, my friend. Suffering made us. Suffering for the people is what we chose because we sympathize so much with their suffering. I know all this, I said. Then listen to me. The chair scraped, and his voice, already high above me, rose even higher. Please understand, I do this to you because I am your friend and your brother. Only without the comfort of sleep will you fully understand the horrors of history. I tell you this as someone who has slept very little since what has happened to me. Believe me when I say that I know how you feel, and that this has to be done. I was already afraid, but his prescription for my treatment magnified my fear even more. Somebody must have something done to him. Was I that somebody? No, that cannot be true, or so I wanted to tell him, but my tongue refused to obey me. I was only mistaken to be that somebody, because I was, I told him, or thought I did, a nobody. I am a lie, a keeper, a book. No, I am a fly, a creeper, a gook. No, I am... The chair scraped again, and I smelled the distinct, gamey odor of the baby-faced guard. A foot nudged me, and I trembled. Please, comrade, I said, just let me sleep. The baby-faced guard snorted, nudged me once more with his horny foot, and said, I'm not your comrade. Chapter 21 The prisoner had never known that he needed a respite from history, he who had committed his adult life to its hot pursuit. His friend Mann had introduced him to the science of history in the study group, its chosen books written in scarlet letters. If one understood history's laws, then one could control history's chronology, wresting it away from capitalism, already intent on monopolizing time. We wake, work, eat, and sleep according to what the landlord, the owner, the banker, the politician, and the schoolmaster command, Mann had said. We accept that our time belongs to them, when in truth our time belongs to us. Awaken, peasants, workers, colonized. Awaken, invisible ones. Stir from your zones of occult instability and steal the gold watch of time from the paper tigers, running dogs, and fat cats of imperialism, colonialism, and capitalism. If you know how to steal it, time is on your side, and numbers are too. There are millions of you and only thousands of them, the colonizers, compradors, and capitalists, who have persuaded the wretched of the earth that capitalist history is inevitable. We, the vanguard, must convince the dark peoples and subterranean classes that communist history is inevitable. The exhaustion of the exploited will inevitably lead them to revolt. But it is our vanguard that speeds up the time toward that uprising, resets the clock of history, and rings the alarm clock of revolution. Tick-tock, tick-tock, tick-tock. Fixed on his mattress, the prisoner, no, the pupil, understood that this was the study group's final session. To be a revolutionary subject, he must be a historical subject who remembered all, which he could do so only by being fully awake, even if being fully awake would, eventually, kill him. And yet, if he could but sleep, he would understand better. He writhed, he wriggled, he wrestled with himself in his failed bid for sleep, and this may have gone on for hours, or minutes, or seconds, when, all of a sudden, his hood was removed, followed by his gag, allowing him to gasp and suck in air. His captor's rough hands plucked away his muffs and earplugs and, lastly, untied the blindfold chafing against his skin. Light! He could see, but just as quickly he had to shut his eyes. Suspended over him were dozens, no, hundreds of light bulbs, planted in the ceiling and blinding him with their collective wattage, their glare radiating through the red filter of his eyelids. A foot pushed against his temple, and the baby-faced guard said, "No sleeping, you." He opened his eyes to the glowing, hot mass of bulbs arranged in an orderly grid, their intense light revealing an examination room whose walls and ceilings were plastered in white. The floor was cement, painted white, and even the iron door was painted white. all in a chamber roughly 3 meters by five. The baby-faced guard in his yellow uniform stood at attention in a corner, but the three others in the room stood at the edges of his mattress, one to either side, and another at his feet. They were dressed in white lab coats and sea-green medical scrubs, hands behind their backs. Surgical masks and stainless steel goggles hid their faces, all six orbital lenses focused on him, who was now clearly not only prisoner and pupil, but also patient. Question, who are you? The man to his left asked the question. Didn't they know who he was by now? He was the man with a plan, the spy with an eye, the mole in a hole. But his tongue had inflated itself to fill his entire mouth. Please, he wanted to say, let me close my eyes. Then I'll tell you who I am. The answer is on the tip of my tongue. I am the gook being cooked, and if you say that I am only half a gook, well, in the words of that blonde-haired major, tasked with counting the communists dead after the battle for Benche, confronted with the mathematical problem of a corpse whose remains included only his head, chest, and arms, half a gook is still a gook, and since the only good gook is a dead gook, as the American soldiers like to say, it must be that this patient was one bad gook. Question, what are you? This came from the man to his right in the commandant's voice. On hearing this voice, the patient lunged against his ropes until they burned his flesh, the question inciting a red flare of silent rage. I know what you're thinking. You think I'm a traitor, a counter-revolutionary, a bastard who belongs nowhere, not to be trusted by anyone. The rage subsided just as suddenly into despair, and he wept. Would his sacrifices never be honored? Would no one ever understand him? Would he always be alone? Why must he be the man to whom things are done? Question, what is your name? It was the man at the end of the mattress, speaking in the commissar's voice. An easy question, or so he thought. He opened his mouth, but his tongue would not move. He shrank in fright. Had he forgotten his name? No, impossible. He had given himself his American name. As for his native name, his mother, the only one who understood him, had given it to him. His father was no help. His father, who never called him son or by his name, even in class, simply calling him you. No, he could never forget his name, and when at last it came to him, he freed his tongue from its gummy bed and said it aloud. The commissar said, he can't even get his name right. Doctor, I think he needs the serum. To which the man on the patient's left said, very well, then. The doctor brought his hands from behind his back, gloved to the forearms in white rubber, one hand with an ampoule the size of a rifle cartridge, the other with a needle. With one smooth stroke, the doctor drew a clear liquid from the ampoule into the needle, then crouched by the patient's side. When he shuddered and twitched, the doctor said, one way or another I'll inject you, and if you move, it will be worse for you. The patient stopped thrashing, and the prick in the crook of the elbow was almost a welcome relief, another kinder feeling than the hallucinatory urge for sleep. Almost, but not quite. Please, he said, turn off the lights. The commissar said, that we cannot do. Don't you see that you must see? The commandant snorted. You will never see, not with all the light in the world. He's been underground too long. He's fundamentally blind. Now, said the doctor, patting the patient's arm. Men of science must never give up hope, least of all when operating on the mind. As we can neither see nor touch his mind, all we can do is help the patient see his own mind by keeping him awake, until he can observe himself as someone else. This is most crucial, for we are the ones most able to know ourselves, and yet the most unable to know ourselves. It's as if our noses are pressed up against the pages of a book, the words right in front of us, but which we cannot read. Just as distance is needed for legibility, so it is that if we could only split ourselves in two and gain some distance from ourselves, we could see ourselves better than anyone else can. This is the nature of our experiment, for which we need one more device. The doctor pointed to a brown leather satchel on the floor that the patient had not noticed but immediately recognized, a military field telephone, the sight of which made him tremble again. The Soviets provided the serum that will compel our patient to tell the truth, the doctor said. This other component is American. You see the look in our patient's eyes? He remembers what he has seen in those interrogation rooms. But we will not be wiring him via nipple and scrotum to the battery terminals of the phone generator. Instead, the doctor reached into the satchel and extracted a black wire. We clipped this to a toe. As for the hand crank, it generates too much electricity. We do not want pain. We do not torture. All we want is enough stimulus to keep him awake. Thus I have modified the electrical output and wired the phone to this. The doctor held up a wristwatch. Every time the second hand crosses 12 o'clock, a brief spark travels to the patient's toe. The doctor untied the burlap stack of wadding from around the patient's foot, and although the patient craned his neck to see the doctor's contraption, he could not elevate himself enough to observe the details. All he could see was a black wire running from toe to satchel, inside of which the doctor had replaced the wristwatch. 60 seconds, gentlemen, said the doctor. Tick-tock. The patient trembled, waiting for the call. The patient had seen how a subject receiving such a call answered it by screaming and flinging about. By the 10th or 20th such call, the subject's eyes took on the glassy sheen of a taxidermically prepared specimen in a diorama, living and yet dead, or vice versa, as the subject anticipated the crank's next turn. Claude, who had taken the class to see such an interrogation, said, "Any of you jokers laugh or get a hard-on, I yank you. This is serious business." The patient remembered being relieved when he was not asked to turn the crank. Watching the subject spasm, he had winced and wondered what the call felt like. Now here he was, sweating and shivering, as the seconds ticked away until a burst of static electricity made him jump, not pained but startled. "See, perfectly harmless," said the doctor. "Just keep switching the wire to different toes so he doesn't get a burn from the wire's clip." "Thank you, doctor," said the commissar. "Now, if you don't mind, I'd like some privacy with our patient." "Take all the time you want," said the commandant, heading for the door. "The patient's mind is contaminated. It needs a thorough washing." After the exit of the commandant, the doctor and the baby-faced guard, but not Sonny and the crapulent major, who observed the patient with great patience as they stood in one corner, the commissar sat down on a wooden chair, the only furnishing in the room besides the patient's mattress. "Please," the patient said, "just let me rest." The commissar said nothing until the next burst of static electricity jarred the patient. Then he leaned forward and showed the patient a thin book, heretofore hidden from him. "We found this in your quarters at the general's villa." "Question: what is the title?" "Answer: Kubark, Counterintelligence Interrogation, 1963. Question: what is Kubark? Answer: a cryptonym for the CIA. Question: what is the CIA? Answer: the Central Intelligence Agency of the USA. Question: what is the USA? Answer: the United States of America. "You see that I hide nothing from you," the commissar said, leaning back. "I have read your marginal notes, taken account of your underlying passages. Everything being done to you comes from this book. In other words, yours is an open book exam. There are no surprises." "Sleep." "No, I am observing you to see if this serum is working." "A gift from the KGB, although we both know what the great powers expect for their gifts. They have tested their techniques, their weapons, and their ideas on our small country. We have been the subjects of that experiment they call, with a straight face, the Cold War. What a joke, given how hot the war has been for us. Funny, but not so funny, for you and I are together the butt of this joke." "I thought we were the butt of the joke," said Sonny. "Hush," said the crapulent major. "I want to hear this. It's going to be rich." "As always," the commissar continued, "we have appropriated their techniques and technology. These light bulbs, manufactured in the USA, and the generator that powers them as well, although the gasoline is a Soviet import." "Please, turn off the lights," the patient said, sweating from the heat generated by the grid of bulbs. Hearing no response, he repeated himself, and when he still heard nothing, he realized that the commissar had left. He closed his eyes, and for a moment he thought he was asleep, until the electricity bit his toe. "I've been subjected to these techniques myself at the farm," Claude had told the class. "They work even if you know what is being done to you." He was referring to the techniques in the mimeographed Kubark manual, now in the commissar's hands, the required reading for the interrogation course. The patient, before he was a patient and when he was only a pupil, had read this book several times. He had memorized its plot, characters, and devices, and he understood the importance of isolation, sensory deprivation, joint interrogators, and penetration agents. He had mastered the Ivan is a dope technique, the wolf in sheep's clothing technique, the Alice in Wonderland technique, the all-seeing eye technique, the nobody loves you technique. In short, he knew this book inside out, including its stress on an unpredictable routine. Thus it was no surprise when the baby-faced guard came in and reattached a wire to one of his fingers. While the baby-faced guard was rewrapping his foot, the patient mumbled something even he did not understand, to which the baby-faced guard said nothing at all. This baby-faced guard was the one who had shown the patient his tattoo, born in the north to die in the south, scripted in blue ink on his biceps. As he was in the last division to march on Saigon, however, the war was over by the time he arrived to liberate the city. But his tattoo might still be prophetic. He had nearly died already from the syphilis given to him by a prisoner's visiting wife, who had paid her bribe with the only resource she had. "Please, turn off the lights," the patient said. But the baby-faced guard was no longer tending him. It was a teenage guard, delivering his food. Hadn't he just eaten? He wasn't hungry, but the teenage guard forced the rice gruel down his throat with a metal spoon. The schedule of his basic necessities must be disrupted. His feeding schedule irregular and unpredictable, exactly according to the book. Like a doctor studying a fatal disease that suddenly afflicts him, he knew everything that had happened and would happen to him, and yet it made no difference. He attempted to tell this to the teenage guard, who told him to shut up before kicking him in the ribs and leaving. The electric wire bit him again, only this time it was not clipped to his finger, but to his ear. He shook his head, but the wire would not release its jaw, nagging at him to stay awake. His mind was raw and chapped, as his mother's nipples must have been after he fed on them. "My hungry baby," she called him. "Just a few hours old. You couldn't even open your eyes, and yet you knew exactly where to find my milk. And once you latched on, you wouldn't let go. You demanded it every hour on the hour." That first sousson of his mother's milk must have been perfection, but he could not remember what it tasted like. All he knew was what it did not taste like. Fear. The sharp, metallic tinge of a 9-volt battery rubbed on his tongue. "Question. How do you feel?" The commissar had returned, looming over the patient in his white lab coat, surgical mask, and stainless steel goggles, his hands in white rubber gloves, holding a notepad and a pen. "Question. I said, how are you feeling?" "Answer. I can't feel my body." "Question. But can you feel your mind?" "Answer. My mind feels everything." "Question. Now do you remember?" "Answer. What?" "Question. Do you remember what you have forgotten?"
And it occurred to the patient that he did remember what he had forgotten, and that if he could just articulate it, the wire would be removed from the tip of his nose, the taste of a battery in his mouth would go away, the lights would be turned off, and he could, at last, sleep. He wept, his tears falling into the vast waters of his forgetting, and that slight saline change to the liquid constitution of his amnesia provoked the obsidian past to rise. An obelisk slowly emerged from his ocean of disremembering. The resurrection of what he did not even know was dead, since it had been buried at sea. Engraved on the obelisk were hieroglyphics, cryptic images of three mice, a series of rectangles, undulating curves, a scattering of kanji, and a movie projector, for what had been forgotten, he now remembered, had occurred in a room they called the movie theater.
"Question. Who called it the movie theater?" "Answer. The policeman." "Question. Why is it called the movie theater?" "Answer. When foreigners visit, the room is a movie theater." "Question. And when foreigners are not visiting?" "Answer. Question. And when foreigners are not visiting?" "Answer. Interrogations are done there." "Question. How are interrogations done?" "Answer. There are so many ways." "Question. What is one example?"
One example? There were so many to choose from. The telephone call, of course, and the plane ride, and the water drum, and the ingenious, scarless method involving pins, paper, and an electric fan, and the massage, and the lizards, and the spot burns, and the eel. None of them were written in the book. Even Claude did not know their origins, only that they had been practiced long before his entry into the guild. "This is going on for far too long," said the crapulent major. "He's had enough." "No," said Sonny. "He's really sweating now. We're starting to get somewhere."
Question. Who was in the movie theater? Answer. The three policemen, the major, Claude. Question. Who else was in the movie theater? Answer. Me. Question. Who else was in the movie theater? Answer. Question. Who else? Answer. The communist agent. Question. What happened to her?
How could he have forgotten the agent with the papier-mâché evidence in her mouth? His own name was written on the list of policemen she had been trying to swallow when she was caught. Watching her in the movie theater, he was certain that she was unaware of his true identity, though he was the one who had passed the list to Mann. But the agent, being Mann's courier, knew who Mann was. She lay in the center of the capacious room, naked on a table, covered with a black rubber sheet, hands and feet roped to the table's four legs. The movie theater was lit only by overhead fluorescent lighting, its blackout curtains puckered shut. Pushed haphazardly against the walls were gray metal folding chairs, while in the back of the room stood a Sony movie projector. On the opposite wall, the movie screen served as the backdrop, from where Claude watched by the projector, of the agent's interrogation. The crapulent major was in charge, but having abdicated his role to the three policemen in the movie theater, he sat watching from a folding chair, his face unhappy and sweating.
Question. Where were you? Answer. With Claude. Question. What did you do? Answer. I watched. Question. What did you see?
Later, sometime in the bright future, the commissar would play the patient a tape recording of his answer, though he had no memory of the tape recorder's presence. Many people who heard their voices on tape thought that they did not sound like themselves, which they found disturbing, and he was no exception. He heard this stranger's voice say, "I saw everything. Claude told me that this was nasty business, but that I had to see it. I said, 'Is this really necessary?' Claude said, 'Talk to the major. He's in charge. I'm just the advisor.' So I went to the major, who said, 'There's nothing I can do about it. Nothing. The general wants to know how she got the names, and he wants to know now.' 'But this is wrong,' I said. 'Don't you see? This doesn't need to be done.' The major sat there and said nothing, and Claude, standing by the movie projector, was also silent. 'Just give me some time alone with her,' I said to the three policemen. Although the Americans called our policemen white mice because of their white dress uniforms and hats, none of these three were mouse-like. They were average specimens of national manhood, slim and gaunt, with deeply tanned skin from riding in jeeps and on motorcycles. Instead of head-to-toe dress whites, they wore field uniforms of white shirts and light blue pants, their light blue caps doffed. 'Just give me a couple of hours with her,' I said. The youngest policeman snorted. 'He just wants first dibs.' I turned red with fury and shame,
and the oldest policeman said,
'The American's not worrying about this. Neither should you. Here, have a Coke.' In the corner was a frigidaire full of soda, and the oldest policeman, who already had an open bottle in his hand, pressed it into mine before ushering me to the chair next to the major. I sat down, and the fingers of my hand, holding the ice-cold bottle, began to go numb. 'Please, sirs,' cried the agent. 'I'm innocent, I swear.' 'That explains why you got a list with all those policemen's names on it,' said the youngest. 'You just found that lying around somewhere, and then got so hungry you had to eat it.' 'No, no,' sobbed the agent. She needed a good story to cover herself, but for some reason she could not come up with it. Not that any story could divert the policeman. 'All right,' said the middle-aged one, unbuckling his belt and unzipping his pants. He was already erect, his 11th finger protruding from his boxers. The agent moaned and turned her eyes away to the other side of the table, only to find the youngest policeman standing there. Having already dropped his pants, he was pumping himself furiously with one hand. Sitting behind him, all I saw were the sunken cheeks of his naked buttocks, as well as the horror in the agent's eyes. She saw that this was not an interrogation, but a sentence, written by the policemen with their instruments in their hands. The oldest, who must have been a father, was fondling the stubby length of the ugliest part of most adult male bodies. This was fully evident to me now that the youngest policeman had turned in profile, bringing himself closer to the agent's face. "Come on, take a look," he said. "He likes you." The three engorged members differed in length, one pointing up, another down. The third bent to the side. "Please, don't do this," the agent cried, eyes shut and head shaking. "I beg you." The oldest policeman laughed. "Look at that flat nose and dark skin. She's got some Cambodian in her, or maybe Cham. They're hot-blooded." "Let's start easy," the middle-aged policeman said, climbing awkwardly onto the table between her legs. "What's your name?" She said nothing. But when he repeated the question, something primitive awoke in her. And when she opened her eyes to look at the policeman, she said, "My surname is Viet, and my given name is Nam." For a moment, the three policemen were speechless. Then they burst into laughter. "This bitch is asking for it," said the youngest. The middle-aged one, still laughing, ponderously lowered himself onto the agent as she screamed and screamed. Watching the policeman grunting and pounding, and the other two shuffling around the table with their pants around their ankles, ugly knees exposed, it seemed to me that they were, after all, mice, gathered around a block of cheese. My countrymen never understood the concept of a queue, no one wanting to be at the end of the line, and as these three mice jostled one another and obstructed my view, all I could see were their sweaty nether regions and the agent's thrashing legs. She was no longer screaming because she no longer could, the youngest policeman having silenced her. "Hurry up," he said. "What's taking so long?" "I'll take as long as I please," said the middle-aged one. "You're enjoying yourself with her anyway, aren't you?" "Stop talking about this," cried the crapulent major, clapping his hands over his eyes. "I can't look." But we were helpless, except to watch as the middle-aged policeman, at last convulsed with a tremendous spasm. Pleasure of this degree should always be kept private, unless everyone was participating, as in a carnival or an orgy. Here, the pleasure was hideous to those who only looked. "My turn," said the youngest, detaching himself from the agent, who was able to scream once more until the oldest took the youngest policeman's place, silencing her. "What a mess," said the youngest, hiking up his shirt. He took his position on the table, undeterred by the mess, and even as the middle-aged policeman zipped up his pants over the frizzy toupee crowning his deflated self, the youngest began repeating his predecessor's motions, reaching, in a few minutes, the same obscene conclusion. Then it was the oldest policeman's turn, and when he climbed on to the table, he left me an unimpeded view of the agent's face. Although she was now free to scream, she no longer did, or no longer could. She was staring directly at me. But with the screws of pain tightened on her jaws and eyes, those screws that turned ever more, I had the feeling she did not see me at all. After the oldest was finished, the room was quiet except for the agent sobbing, and the hiss of the cigarettes being smoked by the other policemen. The oldest, catching me looking at him as he tucked his shirt in, shrugged. "Somebody else would do it, so why not us?" the youngest said. "Don't waste your time talking to him. He couldn't get it up to give her the treatment anyway. Look, he hasn't even touched his soda." It was true. I had forgotten the bottle in my hand. It was no longer even cold. "If you're not going to drink it," the middle-aged one said, "give it to me." I did not move, and the exasperated policeman walked three paces to me and seized the bottle. He took a sip and made a face. "I hate warm soda." He said this with malevolence and offered me back the bottle, but I could only look blankly at it, my mind as numb as my fingers had been. "Wait a minute," said the oldest. "No need to make the man drink warm soda when this one here needs a good washing." He patted the agent's knee, and at that touch and at those words, she came back to life, rearing her head and glaring at us with a hatred so intense that every man in the room should have turned to cinders and smoke. But nothing happened. We remained flesh and blood, and so did she, as the middle-aged policeman laughed, putting his thumb over the bottle's mouth and shaking it vigorously. "Good idea," he said, "but it's going to be sticky." Yes, Memory was sticky. I must have stepped on some of that soda. Even though afterward the policeman had splashed buckets of water on the agent and the table, then mopped the tile floor. I ordered them to do that, said the crapulent major. They weren't happy about cleaning up after themselves, I can tell you that. As for the agent, left on the table, still naked, she no longer screamed or even sobbed, but was dead silent, eyes closed once more, head flung back, back arched. After the policemen had flushed themselves from her, they left the drained bottle inside, buried to the throat of its neck. "I can see right into her," said the middle-aged policeman, bending down to peer through the bottom of the bottle, with gynecological interest. "Let me see," said the youngest, shouldering him aside. "I don't see a thing," he complained. "It's a joke, you idiot," shouted the oldest. "A joke!" "Yes, a very bad joke, a slapstick travesty that one understands in any language, as Claude did." While the policemen played doctor with their makeshift speculum, he came up to me and said, "Just so you know, I didn't teach them how to do that. The bottle, I mean. They came up with it all on their own. They were good students, just like me. They learned their lesson well, and so have I. So if you would please just turn off the lights, if you would please just turn off the telephone, if you would just stop calling me, if you would remember that the two of us were once and perhaps still are the best of friends, if you could see that I have nothing left to confess, if history's ship has taken a different tack, if I had become an accountant, if I had fallen in love with the right woman, if I had been a more virtuous lover, if my mother had been less of a mother, if my father had gone to save souls in Algeria instead of here, if the commandant did not need to make me over, if my own people did not suspect me, if they saw me as one of them, if we forgot our resentment, if we forgot revenge, if we acknowledged that we are all puppets in someone else's play, if we had not fought a war against each other, if some of us had not called ourselves nationalists or communists or capitalists or realists, if our bonzes had not incinerated themselves, if the Americans hadn't come to save us from ourselves, if we had not bought what they sold, if the Soviets had never called us comrades, if Mao had not sought to do the same, if the Japanese hadn't taught us the superiority of the yellow race, if the French had never sought to civilize us, if Ho Chi Minh had not been dialectical and Karl Marx not analytical, if the invisible hand of the market did not hold us by the scruff of our necks, if the British had defeated the rebels of the New World, if the natives had simply said, "Hell no," on first seeing the white man, if our emperors and mandarins had not clashed among themselves, if the Chinese had never ruled us for 1,000 years, if they had used gunpowder for more than fireworks, if the Buddha had never lived, if the Bible had never been written and Jesus Christ never sacrificed, if Adam and Eve still frolicked in the Garden of Eden, if the Dragon Lord and the Fairy Queen had not given birth to us, if the two of them had not parted ways, if 50 of their children had not followed their fairy mother to the mountains, if 50 more had not followed their dragon father to the sea, if Legend's Phoenix had truly soared from its own ashes rather than simply crashed and burned in our countryside, if there were no light and no word, if heaven and earth had never parted, if history had never happened, neither as farce nor as tragedy, if the serpent of language had not bitten me, if I had never been born, if my mother was never cleft, if you needed no more revisions, and if I saw no more of these visions, please, could you please just let me sleep?
Chapter 22. Of course you cannot sleep. Revolutionaries are insomniacs, too afraid of history's nightmare to sleep, too troubled by the world's ills to be less than awake. Or so the commandant said. He spoke as I lay on my mattress, a specimen on a slide under a microscope, and with a shutter's smooth snick, I realized that the doctor's experiment had succeeded. I was divided, tormented body below, flaccid consciousness floating high above, beyond the illuminated ceiling, buffeted from my agony through an invisible gyroscopic mechanism. Seen from this altitude, the vivisection being done to me was actually very interesting, leaving my wobbly body's yolk shimmering beneath my viscous white mind. Thus simultaneously subjugated and elevated,
I was beyond the comprehension of even Sonny and the crapulent major, who remained on the plane of my chronic sleeplessness, peering over the shoulder.